Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Richard Hatch gave up a career as a physicist to become a magician. Although he holds two graduate degrees in physics from Yale University, he says he finds it easier to violate the laws of nature than to discover them. Along with his other work, he's also a one-man historical preservation society dedicated to a German author killed in the Holocaust. A profile was recently published in the New York Times titled How a 1933 Book About Jews and Magic Was Rescued from Oblivion. Hatch, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom. Happy to be here.
Appreciate you you coming in. Tell us briefly about this the spotlight you'll be doing.
Sure. So they're doing three this summer. They've done the first one already. They did three last year. That was their first time doing it. And so 2 weeks ago, Nancy Hills, who just retired from, I think, 34 years with the theater department as their costume faculty person, she was in the spotlight. And it was a lot of fun. Rosemary and I went. It's basically three 20-minute segments with musical interludes in between. So the whole thing lasts about an hour and a half. Richie Call, who is Vasco Call's grandson, by the way, and also head of the lyric program for the summer. He is the host and so welcomes the audience, talks a little bit about Vasco Call and the programming, and then sits down behind a desk, just kind of like Johnny Carson, with a guest at a chair beside him. And so the clock is ticking down from 20 minutes, and that's kind of an interview conversation segment. Not really a This Is Your Life necessarily, but you get to know the person. During that period, people in the audience are encouraged to keep their cell phones on and text questions backstage. So after that first 20 minutes, then there's musical stuff. There's a like four or five piece band there, and some singers came out that are part of the Shaboom program this summer, which Rosemary and I saw last Saturday. It's terrific. Encourage everybody to go. I think they have four more performances of that. Then the second part, another 20 minutes starts counting down. That's the question and answer part. So Richie has questions prepared, but after he's done his prepared questions, then they bring in questions that the audience has texted in for the remaining part of that 20 minutes. Then the musical interlude again. And the final part in the one we saw was a game section, and it was a lot of fun. They had Nancy Hill competing against Dennis Sasson in a movie trivia thing. They mm-hmm. were given quotes from movies and had to guess which movie it was from. The audience could see the name of the movie. Richie Call's three daughters were holding up the signs, but they couldn't see them. And Nancy Hill's won by 1 point and was able to retire with grace. For mine, and tomorrow night, it's Stefan Espinoza and Vanessa Ballum in the spotlight, and I suspect that their final 20 minutes will be them performing. They're very talented actors, singers, and I think the audience will be disappointed if they don't do at least something. Mm-hmm. And similarly for mine, the last 20 minutes will be a performance of effects from my repertoire.
All right. How often do you perform these days?
The article refers to me, I think, properly as semi-retired, and it mentions about once a month, and that's accurate. I'll be doing a private performance for some summer citizens this Wednesday, and then the spotlight thing on the 23rd, and that's all I currently have scheduled professionally as a performer this month. August looks about the same, so it's I'll point this out as a rare opportunity to see me in a public setting. Most of my performances are private settings for individuals, companies that are not open to the public necessarily, but I'm comfortable with the level of performance. It's nice to be semi-retired in that I can turn down things I don't want to do.
Yeah. So for those who don't know you, many in our audience will know you,
sure.
but some, and we broadcast statewide, of course, and worldwide, as I like to say, on
sure,
the Utah Public Radio app.
You bet.
Some may not know you. So deep connections in Utah and Logan, your father's Eastman Hatch, right?
Yes, correct.
Very well known at Utah State University. And beyond. What I didn't know before doing a little research for this interview is you're a descendant of Charles Nibley, who's was a high official in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
He was one of the first presidency under Heber J. Grant. And the town of Nibley here in Cache Valley is named after him, so that's kind of cool. So, I have three of my four grandparents were born and raised here in Cache Valley. The fourth, Calvin Clausen, was born and raised in Salt Lake and has interesting pioneer heritage from that side. But my great-grandfather Nibley was prominent in the valley, a business partner of David Eccles, a junior partner, and both very successful men. And then on the other side, Hezekiah Eastman Hatch was president eventually. He worked his way up to be president of the Thatcher Brothers Bank downtown, more recently people recognize that as what was the Wells Fargo building. I'm not sure what it's been repurposed as now. I guess Cache Valley Bank, I think, might own it, across from the Tabernacle. And Hezekiah Eastman Hatch, my great-grandfather, was born up, was not born, but was raised in Franklin, Idaho, in the Hatch House, which is maintained by the state of Idaho. They consider it the oldest non-indigenous dwelling in the state, built by his father, Lorenzo Hill Hatch, my great-grandfather. So we're sitting adjacent to the Logan Cemetery. I've got lots of ancestors in various Hatch and Thatcher and Nibley plots just adjacent to us. And then my grandmother, maternal grandmother, Ann Clausen, her middle name was Richardson, and she was born and raised in Smithfield, where her father, Joseph Richardson, was mayor for a time. We in the family credit him with securing the funds for the Carnegie Library there. He eventually moved to Salt Lake, where my grandparents met and married.
Wonderful to have those Carnegie Libraries in Smithfield, Richmond, other places.
Sure, it's amazing.
So I understand you developed an interest in magic, and were performing at a pretty early age.
I was probably about 10 or 11. I was homesick, and I'd asked my mom, she said, what could she get me, like at the Woolworths? We were living in Ames, Iowa, where my dad was on the faculty of Iowa State University in the physics department at the time. And I had asked for a magnet set, and she couldn't find it. You know, I must have seen it there to know to ask for it. But she instead picked up a book on magic, The Great Merlini's Golden Book of Magic. The Great Merlini was a pseudonym for a well-known mystery writer at the time, Clayton Rawson. I think he edited Ellery Queen magazine or something. Very good writer. And he wrote a good introductory book on magic for kids. And I learned my first tricks out of that book, gave a little show for family and friends. And that started me on that path. The big hook came. We'd moved to Logan in 1969. I spent my ninth grade year at what was then Logan Junior High, now Logan Middle School. But my 10th grade year, we were vacationing in Europe, and we'd lived there in the 1950s. My brother and I and my parents, my daughter, sister hadn't been born yet, Annie. But I stayed behind, so we had a vacation there, mostly in France, but we started and ended in Germany because we had friends there from when we'd been there in the 50s. And I stayed behind with a family, the Ettengruber family. Some people may know Hans Christian Ettengruber, who spent a year with us here at in Logan, went to Logan High. And still comes back every couple of summers to spend the summer in Utah and traveling around. And that year I spent with the Ettengruber family in a small village outside Frankfurt was really what set the hook on. Magic was my hobby. The mother, Ruth Ettengruber, thought this is something she'd like to encourage. She tracked down a professional German magician who didn't give me formal lessons, but he certainly encouraged me. I would call him a mentor. And you think, how do you find a magician? This is pre-internet. This is 1970, 71. She called a television station in Frankfurt and asked for one there. They gave her the name of an entertainment agent, and the agent gave her the name of this man who lived not too far away and came and visited me. And I had never seen anything. I'd never seen a professional magician in person, and I was super impressed. He was very charismatic, very funny, and extremely skillful. What he did looked to me like real magic. I had no idea how it was done. It just was fantastic. One of the great days in my life's journey, and that really set the hook. You know, I wanted to grow up to be like. Give a shout out to his name. He had a wonderful stage name. He called himself Fredo Raxon, and he built himself not as a German word for magician, which would be Zauberkünstler or Zauberer. He built himself as Internationale Täuschungskünstler, which translates to International Artist of Deception. I thought that was just great. And so my own promotional materials and business cards, instead of having a kind of a generic magician, I built myself as a deceptionist, as a small homage to my mentor, Fredo Raxon. But that really set the hook hard. It became an obsession. So what had been a hobby, and I would do it, you know, I did a talent assembly in ninth grade at the Logan Junior High. But it became, took something that was very extroverted, made it very introverted because of the practice involved. So it was me in front of a mirror with a deck of cards, that kind of thing. And I lost sight of the fact that it was a performing art. So when I went off to college, went to Minnesota, Carleton College, I gave it up cold turkey during my freshman year and didn't pick it up again till much later. So I went to Carleton College for 4 years, graduated, spent a year in Spain basically teaching English. I really regret not having been involved in magic there because the Spanish magicians currently are among the best in the world, and it would have been a great opportunity to be part of that community. Came back and did a year of graduate school at USU in the physics department. My dad was graduate dean at the time, so I figured I'd probably have a foot in the door. I think I would have gotten in anyway, but I needed some credits that I'd gone to physics very late as an undergraduate. My brother, who's a year older, was also going to Carleton College a year ahead of me. And we needed a science credit, and we said we should know something about what Dad does. So we took the Physics for the Poet kind of class, which was written by two professors at Carleton. And one of them was teacher of the course, and it was revolutions in physics. And it didn't require calculus, just a little algebra. It took things from Archimedes and Galileo and then Newton. And finally, in the last chapter, Einstein and his special relativity. And to me, that was mind-blowing. Time dilation and length contraction, that was real magic. So I took the next physics course and the next physics course. And so by the time it was time to declare a major, I had more physics classes than anything else. But I really didn't take any serious physics till my junior year. So I had a lot of gaps to fill in. And I used that year at USU to fill in those gaps and also send out letters to other places, and ended up at Yale University in their physics graduate program. And that's where I met Rosemary. She was not in physics. She was at the School of Music. She's a violinist, and eventually met her, married, had kids, all that kind of stuff. But as the article mentions, when she married me, she thought she was marrying a theoretical particle physicist. And at some point I went to her and said, you know, I want to try this instead. And she's been very supportive, as have my parents, my whole family. So I appreciate that.
So tell me about that. You always had an interest in magic, but put that aside, as you say, quit cold turkey. Went to Yale, graduate degrees in physics. Still had the bug, I'm guessing, right? But so tell me about that transition and deciding, no, I think I want to do magic.
Yeah, one of the reasons I gave it up as an undergraduate was I thought this is totally unrealistic. I mean, I had my mentor in Germany, but German market was very different. I didn't see anyone in the U.S. that was doing kind of what he did. And during my kind of undergraduate years, around then is when Doug Henning made it big on Broadway and had a television special that was a huge hit. And continued to do so. And that opened up a whole world of interest in magic outside the magic community. I mean, we as magicians knew what it was, but people outside didn't. Thought it was just tricks for kids at a birthday party, which it is also. It's a wonderful thing that way, but it's not just that. And so somewhere in that interim between when I gave it up as an undergraduate and went to graduate school, I realized that, you know, there are people now making a living doing kind of what I want to do. So maybe I should rethink that. And back east, I had access to New York and took a lesson from a very famous magician, Slidini. I encourage people to look for his programs with Dick Cavett, who was a student of his and a very good magician himself. They're wonderful tapes of this great magician. And the old obsessions came back. That had kind of been pushed aside to study physics, but they came to the forefront to where they overwhelmed my interest in physics. I never really had a professional ambition in physics. I wanted to learn it. I wanted to understand it, but I didn't necessarily need to practice it professionally. And academic possibilities, I think I would have been a good teacher, but that was very difficult. It would have been easy to find a job in industry with a physics degree, probably not doing what I was trained to do as a physicist, but they would train me to do something else because they figured they could. But I thought, well, let me try it for a year, and I can always go back to physics and finish my degree and go that path. But as it turns out, I couldn't go back to physics now. I'm still interested in it, but they're speaking a whole different language, string theory and multidimensionals and the multiverse and stuff. I'm interested in it, but I don't have a deep understanding of it. I think it'd be hard for me to figure it out now.
Yeah. I was interested by you just parenthetically, you said the Spanish magicians are maybe some of the strongest in the world now. Yeah. Brought up a question, is there a national flavor to, you know, is there a character to Spanish magic and German magic, U.S. magic?
There is, in a way. People with this article have asked me, is there such a thing as Jewish magic? And I'd have to say there's really not. The Jewish magicians that have been so wonderful that are profiled in this book that I translated, they did a repertoire that was similar to the non-Jewish magicians. Many of them were very creative. But I would say there is definitely a Spanish school of magic, and it was started by two men, one of whom is still alive. Ascanio is kind of the father of the Spanish magical group. He has passed away. Professionally, he was a lawyer. He was an amateur magician, but he was a very deep thinker and a great creator, especially of card magic. And he created a whole school of people around him that studied his works and studied with him. And one of his close friends and students is Juan Tamariz, who many regard, myself included, as probably the greatest living magician today. He's in his early 80s. Came to the U.S. recently, the subject of a documentary which is in the final stages of being released, and he was the subject of a New York Times profile about a year or two ago. And because he's been so influential, he's not just a success among magicians, but a popular success. You can't walk down the streets in Spain without being stopped if you're with him and he's being asked to take selfies and give autographs, which he graciously does. But he likes coming to the U.S. where he's totally unknown and he doesn't have to do that. But he's an incredible performer and thinker and shares what he creates with other magicians. And so that's created a whole Spanish school of magic, if you will, and does have its own character. That's unusual. The Dutch are great magicians, have had many world champions in the various magic competitions, and there's a kind of a Dutch school of magic. American magicians is kind of a mixed bag. They go from close-up magicians, which are very fine, to stage magicians, also fine. But there's not – I wouldn't say there's a defining characteristic that you can say that's American magic style particularly.
Mm. Before we get into this fascinating book, Jews and Magic, and the author, Günter Dahmann, I wonder what – just two questions, maybe related, answer them any order you want.
Okay.
What does magic do for you, and what do you want your audience to feel?
Sure. So I love seeing good magic. I love being fooled. Some magicians don't like the word fooled because it sounds like you're being made a fool if you're fooled. And that's not the case at all. It's seeing something and not understanding it, having that sense of wonder, knowing there's something bigger than your understanding, and just having the rug pulled out from under you, and that's kind of dissonance of feeling your sleeve floating in the air. I love that. Now, as a magician myself, often if it's something that I feel like I might enjoy trying to do myself, then I'll want to go to the next step and understand it and try and deconstruct it and see if I can't figure it out. But if it's something that I have no interest in performing, which is true of many things I see that I'd love to see and don't understand how they work, then I can just kind of bask in that sense of wonder. And I think as a kid, that's kind of what helped set the hook, seeing Claxon, for instance, having no idea how he was doing things, and then having that door open to crack by him pointing me in a certain direction and giving me some hints. So what I hope to give my audiences is that similar sense of wonder. I hope they see something they've never seen before that they don't understand in a good way. Some people don't like that feeling. They don't like seeing something that somehow they feel challenges their intellect and they feel foolish, and that's not the point of it. There are things we all don't understand. I use a microwave every day. I don't know how it works, despite my background in physics. I've never explored it. The television, that's a magical thing. I know that someone understands it. I don't feel a need to understand it myself. And I would hope that they would go to a magic performance that way. The magician knows how it's done. You don't necessarily need to know how it's done, but it's something unusual that you're not going to see. It looks like it's impossible, and yet somehow it's made possible. But I hope it also influences some of the audience to get interested in perhaps learning the art themselves and becoming magicians at that level. But it's not for everybody. And I feel bad for the people that are kind of stuck in that stage of being made to feel uncomfortable. It's like a puzzle, and some people find puzzles unsatisfying if they can't turn to the back of the newspaper and get the answer right away. They don't like waiting for it, and that's not the point of magician. So I will say at the question and answer at the lyric, I'm guessing they might get some questions about how did David Copperfield make the Statue of Liberty disappear? And I'll have to defer on those questions. As one of the rules of the art to become a magician, you have to promise not to expose the secrets of the art, and I make my students sign a one-sentence statement saying they won't do that. We spend the first half hour of the lesson explaining why that's true, and just the short answer is it's not to protect the secrets of magic. In this day and age, you can go on the internet, you can pretty much find out anything you want to know. You could Google, how did David Copperfield make the Statue of Liberty disappear? You'll probably find 10 different answers. Maybe one of them is right. Maybe none of them are right. But there are really no secrets. So it's not to protect the secrets. It's to protect our audiences from the secrets. Most people are disappointed when they find out that it's a piece of black thread and double-sided scotch tape rather than some new principle of physics that they didn't know about. So it's to keep maintain that sense of wonder, just as you wouldn't tell a small child things you don't want them to know about, the Tooth Fairy, the Easter Bunny, Santa Claus. Why would you rob them of that childhood experience? At some point, they'll find out.
Right.
But why force them to confront that before they're ready for it?
Right, or how you're stealing their nose or, you know,
exactly.
whatever it might
yeah.
be. Yeah, that yeah. that sense of wonder, you know, we lose incrementally, right?
Sure.
But I guess the magic helps restore that, I suppose, yeah.
That's a great way of looking at it.
Yeah. Well, let's take a break. When we come back, I wanted to dive into this fascinating project you have going, and it hit the New York Times, Salt Lake Tribune. It's all over at this point. So it's a very worthwhile project, translating this book from 1933, Jews in Magic. We have with us a magician, Richard Hatch. How do you like to be described? Magician, deceptionist?
I'm fine with magician. I use deceptionist professionally, but that may have been a marketing mistake because someone used to be, people would say, what do you do? And I'd say, I'm a magician. And they'd say, oh, what instrument do you play? And I'd have to say, oh, no, that's my wife, Rosemary. She's
right.
a violin. I'm a magician. So when I switched to deceptionist, similar problem. I'm a deceptionist. They haven't heard that word. They don't. You answer the phone at the bank? What?
Yeah.
No, sorry.
Right.
So I need some marketing help.
Right. There you go. Okay, wonderful. Also, do you still have Hatch Academy going?
We do.
Yeah.
Rosemary's on the second floor with her studio of the Thatcher Young Mansion downtown, part of the whole Bullen Arts Complex. I used to have the attic, and I loved that space. I gave it up during COVID because I'd stopped teaching, and a visual artist expressed an interest in using that same space as her studio and is doing so. So I still teach, but I share the space with Rosemary when necessary or have students privately in my home.
Yeah. Yeah, that's wonderful. So just another note here, Richard Hatch is presenting the Bosco Call Spotlight at the Lyric Theater in Logan on July 23rd. We'll have more following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We have with us a magician, a deceptionist, Richard Hatch. He gave up a career as a physicist to become a magician. And he's working on publishing a book. He's translated. It's a book we're going to get into talking about right now, Jews in Magic, by Gunther Dahmann, published in Berlin, 1933. And Richard Hatch, with this project, was profiled recently in the New York Times. And that was picked up by the Salt Lake Tribune. It's riding a wave of publicity. Hopefully, Richard, help you get this published. And you've got some copies of this.
I brought copies of the book. It actually has two titles. So it was first published in August, end of August 1933, under, again, I love to say this German title, Die Juden in der Taschenspielerkunst. This is a long portmanteau word, and it's kind of an obscure word even in Germany. Which is maybe why the title got changed. It literally means pocket playing art, and it'd be like using the term legerdemain today. It's just not a common term, Eskimoteur, or Eskimotage, an even more obscure one. So that was in August, and it's a 100-page book of biographies of magicians. No photos, no illustrations, just short biographies, text. In December, and it was self-published by the author in Berlin. He has that this is the second edition, and he gave it a new title, which is this is the more common version, Die Juden, which is the Jews, Die Juden in der Zauberkunst, and that's the more common term for the art of magic. And he put on the title page with the different title, he put that it's the second edition. And that came out in December 1933. Now, I've got these here for you to look at, and you can see actually the second edition is shorter on the edges. Mm-hmm. And the only difference between the first and the second edition is the cover title, the title page title, and there's a little errata sheet stuck in right here, saying change these words. Everywhere it says Taschenspielerkunst, change that to Zauberkunst. So it wasn't reprinted. What he did was take unsold copies of the first printing, trim them, put the new title page and cover on it, and then tip in that errata sheet.
Yeah.
It's not clear how many copies he did. It was self-published. He sent out review copies worldwide to magic organizations and others, and reviews started to come in, many of which were surprised that this book was published in Berlin at that time. Hitler had been appointed chancellor by Hindenburg in January of 1933 and very quickly assumed dictatorial powers. It's astonishing how he was able to do that without much opposition, really. And this young man, who was a Jewish student at the University of Berlin, he was about to take his oral exams to be admitted to complete his doctoral studies. And because he was Jewish, he couldn't complete them. And many of his professors who were Jewish had to terminate their life in Germany, and some of them emigrated to Palestine and other places, America. But he and his family stayed in Germany, and he continued on this project, which he really, I think, viewed as his thesis. Had he stayed in school, he probably would have used this as a basis for a PhD. And we have correspondence that he wrote to a contact in Jerusalem, saying, hey, who was familiar with his book, saying, would it be possible to be granted an honorary doctorate on the basis of this work? So that was clearly a goal. He was also concerned, though, about titles. He said, would it be recognized in Germany as, you know, I'd be Dr. Daman. So one of my goals now is perhaps to get a university either in Germany or Israel to grant him a posthumous honorary doctorate to fulfill that goal. We'll see how that pounds out. But I'm optimistic that it might be possible. But so he self-published this book at the worst possible time and place. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, his family was very wealthy. He was living in a mansion with his brother and his parents in the nicest section of Berlin, Grünewald, and on a Tony Street with other millionaires around them, businessmen. And by 1937, both of his parents died. The house was sold at auction for, I'm sure, pennies on the dollar, as well as its contents. And he had two brothers, and they were forced to find lodging with other contacts, family, friends. Eventually, they were arrested for trying to change what funds they had left from their family on the black market, essentially. They were trying to get foreign currency so that they could emigrate. Their goal at that time was to go to Palestine. And as a result of their arrest, things just got worse. Both brothers died in various camps, one of them in a work camp. It wasn't a death camp. It wasn't an extermination camp. But according to Wikipedia, it was called Großhosen, and the average life expectancy of someone at that quote-unquote work camp was just 2 months. Mm. So they worked the people to death, essentially. His death certificate, that brother says that he died of the flu, which is certainly possible. He's buried with his parents in a huge Jewish cemetery in Berlin that has something like 300,000 or 400,000 plots, gravestones for people. It's enormous. The other two brothers, Günther, who wrote this book, Günther Dahmann, he did slave labor for Siemens cable work, apparently putting hot rubber on wires to coat the cables. But eventually he, along with almost 800 others, were transported from Berlin to Riga in what is now Latvia. And according to the Nazi records, they were all executed, shot upon arrival. So he's probably, there's a mass grave there in a forest, and he's probably one of an estimated 40,000 people in that mass grave outside Latvia, the Birkenes forest. His older brother and the older brother's wife were sent at some point shortly after that, but not long, to Auschwitz, and neither of them survived. So his entire immediate family did not survive the war. I was able to track down two of his first cousins here in America. They had both, they weren't from Berlin. They were from the mother's side of the family. And they, both those families got out in the late 30s and essentially left everything behind. They were forced to, there was like 100% tax on your assets to leave Germany if you were Jewish. And they did it and as a result survived. I think for the Dahmann family, it was harder because they had such great wealth. It's harder to give that up and walk away from it. And by the time they tried, it was too late. And a very sad story.
You mentioned this is obviously very unfortunate timing, the publication of this book. And in fact, in this New York Times article, You're quoted as saying, when you first discovered this book, you thought, oh, this is a Nazi tract, identifying all the Jews we could then kill, right?
Right. Well, I was in the Sterling Library, one of the nation's great academic institutions, libraries, just, millions of volumes. And at that, this is pre-internet, pre-digitization. So you had card catalogs. And it's like, the end of Raiders and the Lost Ark, looking through all the things. So I was going through the card catalog in the magic section, and I came across this title, Die Juden in der Zauberkunst. And having lived in Germany, I understood that that meant Jews in magic. And then I saw the date and place of publication, Berlin, 1933, and my assumption, which turned out to be totally wrong, was that it was an anti-Semitic tract that was showing what scoundrels, what con artists these guys were. And it's just the opposite. It's to show what great contributions they've made historically. And Dahmann got turned on to this subject by his mentor, a great German Jewish illusionist named Ernst Thorn, T-H-O-R-N, and he had traveled the world, including America. I think he actually performed in Salt Lake in the 1870s. I'll have to go back to my records and check. He was traveling with his brother at that time. But he was an older gentleman who was a family friend of the Dahmanns and encouraged Günther's interest. And casually in conversation, as they were strolling once, he happened to mention that many of the people you admire, many of the great magicians of the age, the golden age of magic that they were living through, are Jewish, and that sparked the idea in him. He was interested in who's and contributed to them, and then decided to compile one specific to magicians. Of course, the most famous magician of that time and still today, Harry Houdini, was himself the son of a rabbi, and so he's prominently featured in the book. But there's several dynasties, the Hermann dynasty, which started in Germany but moved to France, and eventually the most famous of them settled in the U.S., Alexander Hermann, known universally as Hermann the Great, performed in Salt Lake almost every season during his heyday. He died in 1896. He was the younger brother of Kompars Hermann, who had a great career in Europe. They kind of divided. Alexander kept North America, and his older brother kept the Western Europe. They had both performed for Abraham Lincoln, with the younger brother assisting his older brother in the 1860s. But another dynasty out of Amsterdam, the Bamberg family, six and sometimes by, depending on how you count it, successive generations of magicians, and very successful. The last two particularly, Okito was a worldwide sensation in vaudeville with a silent act. He pretended initially to be Japanese and then changed to Chinese. His real name was Theodore Bamberg, or Tobias Bamberg. His wife didn't like the name Tobias because she was English and it sounded like her dog Toby, so he changed it to Theo Bamberg. But his stage name, he chose a Japanese-sounding name, Okito, which apparently the letters of Tokyo unscrambled, or Kyoto, the capital at that time, to make Okito. Later, he became a pseudo-Chinese performer, but he kept that name. He was extremely prominent when this book was published in music halls in Europe, including the Wintergarten and other theaters in Berlin. He'd performed in Hamburg that January of 1933. But when the book came out, there's a whole page on the Bamberg family, mentions every generation, but when it comes, it skips a generation. It mentions his father, known to magicians as Papa Bamberg, who was the court magician in the Netherlands, and then it mentions his son, David Bamberg, who performed very successfully throughout Latin America under the stage name Fu Manchu, again, a Chinese impersonator. But it deliberately does not mention Okito. And it's probably by Ed Okito's request. He had a career in Germany. He wasn't particularly known to theater owners as Jewish. They thought he was Chinese. I don't have any evidence that he performed in Germany after Hitler came to power. But his omission is striking in this. And we have a correspondence in the article I wrote back in January. We reproduce a letter from Okito to Dahmann written in December of 1932, just before Hitler came to power, saying, hey, yeah, what you've written is fine. Whatever you do with it, it's okay by me. Well, later he must have changed his mind, or Dahmann decided. Dahmann in his introduction says, talking about the book and the contributions of Jewish magicians, he says, when it comes to contemporary magicians, because many of them are historical and from the past, including a fascinating character who called himself Philadelphius, who was born in Philadelphia, so his stage name was from the city of his birth. His career was exclusively in Europe. His real name was Jacob Meyer. He's believed by some to have been the first Jew born in the city of Philadelphia. Anyway, so he died many years before the book was published. But when he says when it comes to contemporary performers, I've been very careful about who to include. There are contemporary performers in it, but several names are ones we know that he knew about, but that he doesn't talk about to protect their careers and as it turned out, in some cases, their lives. Four people that he does mention did die as a result of the Third Reich period. One was in Holland, and of course, at the time the book was written, Holland was free and independent, but then got taken over. One was in Hungary, again, you know, not subject to German law at the time the book was written, and then Daman himself. And I'm blanking on the third one, but I think he was probably also someone living outside Germany at the time, I think in Prague in Czechoslovakia. But of those in the book that were living at the time, I was able to track down one who had made it to America, an Austrian magician who in America, he specialized in stage, so theatrical pickpocket work. A fascinating fellow, Fred Rohner was his name. By the time I met him, he'd been long retired. He had a second career as an artist. You can find his paintings on eBay fairly frequently. I had a studio in Greenwich Village, but a fascinating character. And one of his things he was proud of as a technical thing was there's an effect in magic called card to wallet, and many magicians do it. I've done it myself, where a chosen card, often signed, disappears from the deck, lost in the deck, shuffled up, and then it disappears from the deck and it reappears in the performer's wallet. So it's a translocation. It goes to an impossible location. Fred Rohner was very proud of the fact that his didn't go to the performer's wallet. It went to the spectator's wallet. So the spectator chooses a card. It's lost in the deck, and it ends up in the spectator's wallet. And he told me, kind of a technical thing without giving too much away, he said, he, as a pickpocket, he never had any trouble secretly removing the spectator's wallet. The challenge was secretly putting it back in after the card was inside it. So, and I don't know anyone else that's attempted to do that.
Let's take another break. When we come back, I want to talk a little bit more about Daman and Jews in magic. We're talking with magician Richard Hatch. A profile was recently published in the New York Times titled How a 1933 Book About Jews and Magic Was Rescued from Oblivion. This is a project of Richard Hatch's. He's trying to get this published. He's translated this book. We'll have more following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We have with us magician Richard Hatch. He is working on a project. He's translated this book we've been talking about, Jews in Magic, and his goal is to get this published. And he's profiled in the New York Times in a recent article, which is picked up by the Salt Lake Tribune, so a lot of publicity here. Before we get back into this, Richard Hatch, I was reading another profile of you that you have on the website for the Hatch Academy. I don't know why this struck me so much. Maybe it's some principles of magic in real life. You were traveling, I think, in Mexico, if I got this right. This is when you were a young man. I don't know if you remember. I probably do remember this as I give you the more of the details. And you're going to take a bus, I think. Somebody rudely gets in ahead of you in line. And so you're angry, and your attention is directed at this rude man. Meanwhile, his companions pick your pocket.
Yes.
And so this is misdirection, a very crude misdirection, but some of the principles of magic in real life.
Right. No. So I was a victim of a pickpocket team in Mexico. I was traveling there. It was between – I finished a semester at Utah State University and was planning to go in the fall to Yale, and in between I decided to – traveled down to Mexico. I'd spent a year in Spain, so I wanted to kind of refresh and keep fresh my Spanish skills. And I wanted to go to an archaeological site, so I was at a train station waiting to get to the ticket window. And, you know, you're waiting in line, you're waiting, you're kind of impatient, the train's going to leave. And just as I get to the ticket window, a person cuts in front of me to get their ticket. So I'm focused on this person who's butted in line. I'm angry with them. I want to get my ticket. And by the time he goes away and I get to the window, I go for my wallet and it's not there. Now, there was no mystery. I could see the guy is running away. Mm-hmm. And there was also no satisfaction. You know, I went to the local police department and, you know, what can they do? I mean, there's nothing they can do. They took a report and that's it. I did make it to the archaeological site eventually. But it was frustrating because they might have been tracking me since I'd gone to a bank to change some traveler's checks that day, some American Express checks. They might have spotted me there and followed me from there to the train station for all I know. But it didn't ruin the whole trip, but it was an educational experience. And that's, mm-hmm. As you say, the crudest kind of misdirection. Misdirection is really directing attention. Obviously, my attention was forcefully directed at the person I was mad at in front of me. And so I didn't notice the people on either side that were cleaning out my pockets. For magicians, the best misdirection is like a perfect crime. You never know that you've been subject to it. By the time you realize something's happened, you can't explain it because you can't reconstruct the steps involved. Here, it was obvious. Again, there was no mystery, so there was no feeling of joy at having experienced something impossible. But it's a similar principle with a different end, obviously.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious. Obviously, when you're on stage, it appears effortless. I'm sure there's a lot of practice to prepare your magic.
Sure. I enjoy practicing. I enjoy the physical, holding the cards or the coins or the rings, whatever it is, the instrument that I'm working with, if you will. But it does, it's not something, as a kid in high school, before going to Germany, I would typically buy a prop at a magic store. There was one in Salt Lake at the time, Loftus, which still exists not as a store, but as a wholesale company in Salt Lake. Gene Rose was the owner, and I would buy something there, go home, read the instructions, run through it, so rehearse it a few times, and then you could do it. And when I went to Germany, my experience changed because what Roxon didn't rely on a special prop. He prided himself on using ordinary objects to create these extraordinary effects, and that became my goal as well. So I have nothing against what you might call prop magic. It's wonderful, and there's some great secrets, and it takes great skill to present it entertainingly. But I always, after seeing him, I realized that, the magic prior to that was in the prop, in the secret, in what I'd purchased. And I wanted to be given the credit, not the prop. So I started to practice. And as I say, it took what had been a very extroverted activity, hobby, and made it a very introverted one. So to the point where I eventually gave it up in college, cold turkey, and then didn't get back to it in college. Just to step back a bit to the story about the book. So I discovered it in that Yale library, dismissed it, didn't check it out, didn't look at it, because I assumed it was not something of interest to me. Who wants to read Nazi propaganda? Years later, after I dropped out of college, I didn't have a lot of performances. I didn't know how to get performances. So there was that year where in the New York Times article, Rosemary's quoted as saying she was the breadwinner for a year. And it was probably more than a year. But during that period, I needed something to do. And I decided to translate a book from German into English about a 19th century Viennese magician with another wonderful name, Johann Nepomuk Hofzinser. He was born in 1806, died in 1875, and is regarded as the father of modern card magic, but he did all kinds of magic. And that book got published in 1985 and brought me to the attention of the wider magic collecting community. And someone in that community said, if you're looking for another project, take a look at this book that I have, quite a rare volume. And it was this one that Yale also had. And that opened my eyes to the fact that it wasn't at all what I thought it was. And with his encouragement and many others, I decided to do it. There's a book that was published in 1990 called Who's Who in Magic. And in the entry under Günter Dahmann, the author of the book, it mentions the title of the book. And then parenthetically, and this is in 1990, it says German English translation by Richard Hatch forthcoming. That was in 1990. So it really took COVID to give me the space to say, okay, I'm not doing any performing right now. Let me finish that project up, because I kind of picked away at it, but I hadn't really gotten serious about it. So I did finish it up, and then the next step becomes finding a publisher. Now, we have several people that are interested in it. The problem is finding the right mix. We could easily have it published for people interested in magic history, which is a very niche market, and there are fine publishers that we'd be happy to work with there. I say we because I have a couple of publishing partners, an attorney near Washington, D.C., Kenneth Trombley, who has a fantastic collection of magic, and a friend of his and mine, Dr. retired physician, heart surgeon Bruce Averbuch in the Cleveland area. Again, fantastic private museum of magic. And they've both been encouraging me for probably the last 10, 15 years to finish this up. And their vision for it, which I sympathize with, and hope it's realistic, is to have a book that would be more widely distributed, to get the story out to a general public, not just to those that are already interested in magic and magic history, so that maybe a young kid could find it in his school library and be inspired to become a magician himself.
Mm. I was touched by this the analogy. You use a saying in this article in the New York Times. There's a saying, you say you all die three times. Yeah. Tell me about that and what your ultimate goal is here with Daman.
Yeah, so I see him as there were obviously many victims, 6 million and more victims of the Nazi period, and there are horrible things going on today all over the world. But, you know, his story resonated with me. A young man, a university student, interested in magic history, goes to the trouble to do the research, all pre-internet. So it's a tremendously different thing than today, where you can push a button and pull up all kinds of information. He had to dig through volumes in several different languages. And he worked hard to do this. And as I say, he viewed it really as his magic thesis, kind of like I viewed my translation of the book about Hofzinser as my magic thesis when I decided to not pursue a doctorate in physics. So I'd like to honor his memory. That saying, I think it may have become popularized by the Disney movie about the Day of the Dead. I'm blanking on the title of that movie, but it takes place in Mexico.
Right, I can't think of it either. Yeah.
But I think they have something similar to that in there. And it's like, there's obviously when your body physically dies, your heart stops beating. Then when you're either buried or cremated, that would be the second time your body physically is destroyed. And then the third time is when the last person mentions your name out loud, and that's going to come for all of us. It's none of us is immortal in this earthly sphere, but it seemed to me worthwhile to keep his name in people's mouths for as long as I could, as my little mitzvah for his effort.
Oh, it's wonderful. It's a wonderful project. We just about reached the end of our time. So the next goal is to get it published.
There are several publishers talking to us. We're always looking for more. We'd like to find the right mix. There are a couple of documentary filmmakers that have reached out. Within hours of the New York Times article coming out, acclaimed documentarian Ken Burns sent me an email. So that was pretty exciting. He followed up with two more. However, both of them were asking me to donate money to Senate candidates in the Midwest, so that was a little disappointing.
Yeah.
But I have been contacted by several others who are interested in the story, and all of it would help bring attention to this poor gentleman's life and work and keep it alive.
Yeah, well, thank you for doing that. Richard Hatch, such a pleasure. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you. Pleasure of mine.
And thanks, everyone, for listening to Access Utah today.
This is Wild About Utah.
I stepped outside on election morning into a gusty, cold wind. Leaves skidded across the ground, mixed with heavy grapple which fell hard from the sky, pelting me from all directions. Grapple is a type of snow, soft, hail-like miniature snowballs that fall with turbulent winds typically associated with either the beginning or the end of a storm cycle. It seemed fitting, and it made me smile, in a curious and uneasy sort of way. To the west, through the dim gray rage of the storm, the Wellsville Mountains appeared to glow in the morning light. Regardless of the outcome of the election, the earth keeps turning, and though elections can and do have direct impact on the wildlands of Utah and the health of our planet, today the crows in the yellow pine in my front yard still call out, "Caw, caw, caw." The snow still accumulates on the highest peaks. Squirrels still scurry frantically to cache enough supplies for winter. The Bear River keeps flowing to the Great Salt Lake, steady and silent. In this climate of divisiveness, I want to believe, at the core, we all share similar values that we express differently. I found myself reflecting back on September 11, 2001, how helpless I felt watching the news throughout the day. Late in the afternoon, I headed up Logan Canyon to center my thoughts and to finish a climbing route I had been working to establish. I carefully painted the last bolt anchor at the top of the climb with stars and stripes. It wouldn't be visible from below, and named the route Old Glory. That time alone on the mountain brought clarity. I came home, called the scouts and my troop, and told them we were flying the flags and to meet at my house as soon as they could. Troop 1, at the time, volunteered to hang the U.S. flags on Main Street in Logan for the holidays. It was a task I dreaded sometimes, because it was an inconvenience. Suddenly, it felt like the most important thing we could do. I didn't ask permission from anyone. I had the key to the flag shed. 4 or 5 teens and I loaded 100 American flags into my van. As we drove slowly down Main Street, hazards flashing, stopping at each light post so the boys could mount each flag, everyone driving past honked and cheered. The boys knew we were part of something special that night, something that mattered. We were part of building a sense of resilience and unity. I have flown the flag at my house ever since. United we stand. Votes are being cast as I write. When this segment airs on Monday, we should know the outcomes of local, state, and national races. And those first rays of sunshine that set the Wellsvilles aglow through the grapple this morning, I hope they are a signal for all of us that the end of this storm is near. I hope we can all move past hate, past fear, past division, to a place of understanding that the left wing and the right wing are extensions of the whole bird. My wife shared Mary Oliver's poem, I Worried, with me this morning, and I think I shall do as Mary did. She wrote, "Finally, I saw that worrying had come to nothing and gave it up and took my old body and went out into the morning and sang." I am Eric Newell, and I am Wild About Utah.